Hey everyone, I'm Eli Lake. I'm here today with Adam Server of the American Prospect, and we are going to discuss whether or not there is a cultural war on Islam in America. How are you today, Adam?
I'm all right. How are you doing? If I could just explain the picture behind me at the moment, it's apparently a picture of an extraordinary rendition. Despite the fact that I write that kind of stuff, I'm actually not. I wasn't actually the person who made the choice to put it there. But fortunately, I don't have to look at it every day.
Okay.
But my
is it like actually? Well, I'm not. I can't see it. That's the thing about blogging heads. So describe it for us, or for me at least.
It's a picture of a hooded man in an orange jumpsuit being dragged by two guys in suits to a waiting plane.
Got it.
Pretty okay. Disturbing, huh?
Well, that's your war on terror.
Yep.
Okay. All right, so let's... We were tweeting yesterday, and someone, I believe Max Fisher, brought up the phrase that there was a cultural war against Islam in America. And I sort of dissented on Twitter, but I have since kind of looked at some of the material that people have been linking to, including Glenn Greenwald, and, I still don't think that there's a cultural war against Islam, but why don't you make the case for why you think that is, and then we'll talk about the Ground Zero Mosque and everything, or I should say the two blocks from Ground Zero Mosque, the Cordoba House. Why don't you go first?
I think it's actually more helpful to look at I don't think there's a culture war on Islam. I think there's a culture war over Islam. I think the idea that there's a culture war on Islam maybe even gives American Muslims more of a role than they actually have in it. I think what there is there's an argument over how Islam should be, Americans should deal with Islam both in the United States and abroad that's occurring between liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, and among them. But that I think should actually be looked at in the context of a sort of larger culture war, which I think Ben Smith and Jonathan Martin nailed earlier today in a Politico piece where they said the culture war now is not actually primarily about abortion or crime. It's really about sort of what it means to be an American. And I think that if you look at it that way, the sort of broader debates that we've been having, not just about Islam, but about immigration, stuff like that, it actually makes a lot of sense. But in terms of Islam in particular, I mean, I think there is widespread prejudice on both sides of the aisle against Muslims. There's a belief that there's a lot of suspicion. There's a belief that Muslims, American Muslims, aren't integrating, that they hold a lot of that they hold animosity towards the United States. But I think most disturbing, there's this sort of idea that, Muslims should be treated differently than other Americans because they're potential traitors. And I think you see this, and this is actually somewhat of a new thing. Like George W. Bush was obviously very, very good at drawing a line between extremists and mainstream Muslims, but you look at people like Newt Gingrich taking this whole idea of sort of stealth jihadist, which, you know, brings sort of any kind of religiously based Muslim advocacy into the realm of sort of terrorist subversion. I mean, that concept used to sort of exist on the fringe of the right. Now it's something that we're actually all talking about. We're actually all talking about the possibility that Muslims are infiltrating the United States with the purpose of establishing Sharia law.
Besides Newt Gingrich.
Well, I don't think it's just Newt Gingrich. I mean, I think that broadly speaking, you're seeing a lot more people sort of entertain this idea in a way that we haven't been seeing before. I mean, I think one of the good things is that this last incident has brought out a lot of Republicans who disagree with that view of things, but I think there's no question that it's gained traction.
Well, I mean, listen, there's certainly a movement politically. Newt Gingrich clearly is part of that. Andy McCarthy, Andrew Bostrom, Robert Spencer, the blogger, Pamela Geller, believe that when bin Laden and Zawahiri say that they are the true representation or avatar of Islam, that they are speaking correctly. But that is a contrast to the former President George W. Bush, myself, I'm sure you, and lots of other people, including David Petraeus, who believe that the sort of ascetic Salafism of Al-Qaeda is a deviation from what would be called mainstream Islam. You know, I don't think that's particularly controversial, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's accurate.
So, I mean, I think that so there is, I guess, there's an element of the right that seeks to sort of make this case, which you know, I mean, I think that they're wrong on the merits, but I also think it's a little too easy to just sort of dismiss and say, you know, that, you know, to sort of just, it's a comforting thought, but there is something problematic about, at least in the Middle East, how a lot of mainstream Islam is understood. And that oftentimes I think that there are people who are moderate, considered moderate Muslims. I mean, let me give you an example. In Lebanon recently, Sheikh Fadlallah, do you remember this when Octavia Nasser praised Sheikh Fadlallah's views on women? Do Adam?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I remember that.
Hezbollah, or kind of a Shia cleric in Lebanon, right? Who did counter a lot of more radical clerics in Lebanon when he said, you know, women should, you know, have jobs, and he was, I think, opposed to female genital mutilation, and other things, which I suppose makes him a reformer of sorts. However, he went to his grave, you know, openly seeking, you know, supporting terrorism against Jews in Israel. Mm-hmm. So is this guy a moderate Muslim? Yeah, he is. But moderate Islam, at least in the Shia clerisy of Lebanon, encompasses, nonetheless, kind of a fanatical Jew hatred. And this is, like, a real, I think, so that's one thing I would point out. It's not really pertinent to the, you know, McCarthy, Geller, Gingrich point, you know what I'm saying? Because I think I'm with you in saying that they're wrong, that in fact there isn't, you know, that you can't, that, or to put it another way, they would say that to be an observant Muslim, you had to almost embrace a kind of jihad against the West, which I think is wrong. And I know it's wrong, having lived in Muslim country in Egypt and talked to plenty of pious Muslims who reject that. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, there's something about a lot of mainstream Islam that is not like other Abrahamic faiths when it comes to not just Israel, but also the notion of apostasy. I mean, when I was in Malaysia recently, Adam, there were mainstream Islamic parties. The ruling party itself were, you know, talking about laws to try to, you know, basically take legal measures and punitive action against people who left the faith of Islam.
I don't know
of other Christian or Jewish or other religious groups that sort of spend their time thinking and actually worrying about this. And these people were by no means members of Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
So
no, I mean,
think, I think that there is, I guess what I'm trying to say is that, yes, I grant that Al-Qaeda is a fringe fanatical movement, but there's also something that's less than Al-Qaeda that still is somewhat disturbing, and we can talk about that in an American context too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think the problem is that there's a tendency, I mean, obviously when we're talking about moderates, particularly for the purpose of American foreign policy, we're grading on a curve, right? So someone...
I would argue that just as moral human being, I mean, like, I don't know, like, it's not okay to say, listen, I'm like really good on healthcare, but, you know, when I, you know, but I also support, you know, I don't know, indiscriminate carpet bombing of Muslim countries, right?
Right. But what I guess I'm saying, I mean, these are, I think, two different things, but I think it's one thing to say, I mean, like, if you say, you know, we're at war with Islam, you can't even, I mean, like, there's sort of, I mean, there's a total cognitive dissonance there, because if you're at war with Islam, you're unable to, say, exploit rival factions among people who may not, you know, someone who's a bad guy but who's not as bad as this other bad guy who can be of use for putting that other bad guy down. I'm thinking of something like, you know, Hamas, you know, who are obviously not the good guys, putting down, you know, Takfiri revolutions inside Gaza. I mean, like, I think there's a difference between that and saying, you know, to say that we should reach out to these people or talk to these people is not the same thing as denying that they have these terrible liberal impulses. where I think
well,
that
I'm saying something different. I'm agreeing with you that it's foolish and incorrect to be at war with Islam. It doesn't make good strategic sense, nor is it accurate analysis. So
right, but I don't disagree. We do agree on that.
I'm saying, nonetheless,
but the problem with what these folks are saying is ultimately, in my view, positive sum interaction with the West is a moderating force on those kinds of liberal impulses. So it's one thing to say these people do horrible things, we shouldn't talk to them ever. I think that actually sort of locks them into a space where those kinds of liberal impulses can persist. I think cultural and economic exchange.
We don't have to do it. It depends on the context. I mean, in the Egyptian context, if you care about democratization in Egypt, then you have to deal with Ikhwan or the Muslim Brotherhood there, who have actually served, have been extremely helpful to the Egyptian government in rooting out Jamaat Islamiyah and the followers of the breakaway Qutubist faction that ultimately gave us the Zawahiri and the assassination of Anwar Sadat. So we know from Saad Ibrahim that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is actually a force for counterterrorism, and we know that people who are less radical in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt probably sort of helped counsel people like Dr. Fadl, who is a former, kind of jihadist theologian for Al Qaeda, to denounce some of his views. And all of that is probably there's probably something to be said for U.S. interaction with that in the context of just up, the Sinai to Gaza to Hamas. Reaching out to Hamas at this point would be to, in some ways, abandon the wishes of Mahmoud Abbas and Salam Fayyad, who have been praised by the world over as these moderate reformers in
the I didn't actually mean to say that I wasn't actually making an argument necessarily for engaging Hamas. What I was saying is I was using that as an example of why it's not helpful to look at these things as monolithic. I think we both agree
we're not to look at it a monolith. Right. What I'm trying to say, though, is that insofar as if all Andy McCarthy wants to say, and I did not think his book was nearly as terrible as some of the critics, insofar as Andy McCarthy wants to say, listen, there are people who are ostensibly kind of under the banner of Islam in this country, have a pretty expansionist agenda to unify America's Muslims, and that we move beyond some of the uglier protests in Tennessee against just any old Islamic center, and to are you going to have demands for gender segregated swimming pools and so forth, and I think that McCarthy is sort of pointing out that there is a kind of cultural and in some cases legal agenda of some of these groups that originate overseas that are coming to the United States and seeking to kind of unify the American Muslim community. Now, is there about that in such a way that, like, we can have a conversation without going crazy in either direction? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that I think that generally Americans, I think Americans and liberals in particular resist the impulse to enshrine those kinds of religious liberal tendencies in American law. I mean, like, we have a tradition of separation of church and state, and I think there's this theory that liberals suddenly don't care about that tradition when Islam is involved, and I think there's a broader thesis of McCarthy's book that I find really ridiculous, which is the idea that it's like these sort of undercover Islamists and the American left are in cahoots to undermine the United States, and the argument for that is things like, liberals want detainees at Guantanamo to have lawyers. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, I think it was the Forward did a profile of a number of the lawyers for the defense lawyers, civilian defense lawyers at Guantanamo Bay, and like a bunch of them are, Zionist Jews. Like the fact is, McCarthy doesn't just equate mainstream Muslims in the United States with this sort of secret revolution. He equates a liberal view of the rule of law with wanting to foster that secret revolution. And I think that's what's really problematic, because what you're essentially saying is that both liberals and Muslims need to be viewed as kind of fifth columnists trying to destroy the country. And you can't
I'm not going to defend that view. I don't think that's right.
Right, right. But
I don't necessarily think that's a little bit of a crude interpretation of what he's talking about.
Yeah. I'm sorry? The conversation that we're talking about resisting a liberal tenets, I mean, like, I just think it's a mistake to view Muslim religious-based advocacy as fundamentally different from any other kind of religious-based advocacy. I mean, when people say, you know, Muslims are taking advantage of our tolerance and our freedom of religion to fundamentally change our society, well, I mean, you know, that's what tolerance means. It means you allow people who might have a liberal tendencies based on religion to make their case in the marketplace of ideas. And frankly, I think those liberal ideas will lose, but you don't criminalize them just because they happen to be different from your religious ideas.
I don't think anybody is arguing for the criminalization of belief here. I mean, we had this debate a little bit on Twitter. Yeah, there are some fringe right folks who seek to use the landmark process, zoning process in New York and Manhattan to stop this Cordoba House Islamic Center from being built.
It was the gubernatorial nominee. I mean, Rick Lazio went to the landmark hearing and said these people are being funded by terrorists. I mean, like, or suggested it. I mean, that's...
Well, okay. Well, they have $18,000 in the bank, so we don't know who's funding them. Let's table this for a second because I do want to get to it, but I want to get back to the point about McCarthy. My sense of what McCarthy's saying, and I don't want to... My sense is that he's got two things going on. One is, as a former prosecutor for the 93 World Trade Center bombers and the Blind Sheikh, McCarthy believes that a kind of rule of law approach to radical Islam or al-Qaeda, whatever you want to say, is inadequate to protect the United States. He's putting that out there. He's very clear and explicit about that. And I think you can say that. You can say, I think that an ACLU-approved approach that doesn't have any kind of detainees or any extrajudicial killings or any kind of things that have been objected to by civil libertarians is that's taking this approach will not make us safe. It does not say that the people who advocate for taking that approach are fifth columnists. It's just saying... What you want?
No, but he says that. I mean, I think people can say that. I think you do say. I think you do say that. I think other people. I think Ben Wittes, for example, says that. Or Ken Anderson. These people, there are a lot of people who argue for that. For more expansive presidential power in the war on terror, who do it without sort of suggesting.
Well, actually,
I've
kind
with
of
them
argued about the danger of that expansive presidential power. But
and you have,
Yes. But I hear you. I guess what I'm saying is that, like, I think that's one argument he's making. And then he's making another argument, which is, listen, I've looked at a lot of evidence that's come out. And he would say, I think, well, I mean, maybe we should, you know, it's one of those, like, I happen to have Marshall McLuhan right here, but I don't have him right here. So, and I don't want to kind of get into a position to be his person. But I think that then a second thing he's interested in is looking at who is funding the expansion of a lot of mosques in the United States. And he's particularly interested in this 1991 memo that was disclosed, a memorandum from the International Muslim Brotherhood
from
1991 from the Holy Land Foundation trial. And that's really, I have to say, an interesting and intriguing memo, but it's by no means the Rosetta Stone. Because, I mean, I'm currently in the process of doing quite a bit more reporting on that. And, you know, so I don't know that this is necessarily case closed, but raising this issue that, hey, wait a second, there are people who come, you know, who have this agenda in this country, even if you want to say it's not illegal for them to do any of this stuff, but still saying, you know, using your free speech rights, I mean, that alone, it seems like...
But I don't think that's an exploitation of...
There hasn't been an elite conversation about, you know, what's going on there.
I don't think that's an exploitation of freedom of speech. I think that's freedom of speech. I mean, like, frankly, there are a lot of things, like, that the religious right would want to do in this country that I don't agree with, like criminalizing abortion or something like that.
Sure.
Or prohibiting same-sex marriage. But I don't think it's fundamentally illegitimate for them to advocate for those things, or that advocating for those things makes them an enemy of the United States. Or that, you know, because McCarthy takes several extra steps, which is he's not just saying that, you know, this kind of religious-based advocacy is, you know, is trying to fundamentally change our country. I mean, lots of people want to fundamentally change our country. What he's saying is that that's almost indistinguishable and linked to the sort of vision of Osama bin Laden, Al Qaeda, and thus, you know, fundamentally,
okay, on this,
whether you advocated for violence or not, it's
on that point. I do get off the Andy McCarthy train.
Okay,
and I believe you do too. So I mean, so on this, we'll agree that, like, obviously, if there's quite a bit of advocacy, but I'd like to just get back to now. Let's talk about the Cordoba House and so forth.
Okay.
So my position is, I don't care. Don't think that people have a right in a free society to be unoffended. So, in the sense that, you know, I believe in the property rights, and if they've gone through all the zoning commissions, then there's so that's my position on it. That was the sense of that I got from the National Review editorial and other positions on the right, including kind of Sarah Palin's Facebook posts and so forth, is that they're simply saying, you know, we're offended and we would appeal to the people who are behind this project to choose another site. That was also, I think, basically what Howard Dean was saying. And to me, that sentiment, and I want to distinguish that from Murfreesboro, Tennessee mosque protesters and so forth, or for that matter, some of the uglier protesters on the actual site of the Burlington Coat Factory. But just that sentiment, you know, we're offended, could you pick another place for it? That doesn't strike me as a great test of religious liberty. It strikes me as like, it's a bit, it's an inadequate conversation, and it's a proxy for a deeper conversation, but, you know, there it is.
Right. I mean, I think there isn't really much of a way to make the case that the building, which is, you know, not... I think there's an impression that the mosque will be built with the ashes, with bricks from the ashes of Ground Zero, and there will be, you know, a golden statue of Osama bin Laden in the front. But I mean, like, I think it's very difficult to make the case that this project, which replaces an already existing Muslim prayer space in the same building, is offensive unless you're on some level holding Muslims as a whole responsible for the acts of Al-Qaeda. And I think that you're right. I mean, in a broader sense, you know, people advocating against the project now certainly do have a constitutional right to do that. But I think that we're sort of doing ourselves a disservice if we don't, if we look at sort of mob coercion as indistinguishable or not alarming. As long as that mob coercion doesn't come from the government, it's not government coercion, it's not alarming at all. I mean, frankly, if someone wanted to build a synagogue somewhere in the United States and everybody was screaming, you know, this is going to be, these people agree with terrorists, these people are extremists, they're going to do violent things, you know, and there was a huge, it became a national issue, I would be frightened. And I think you would be too.
I don't know. I mean, listen, it is two blocks away from Ground Zero. Well, I'm not personally...
But it already is.
I'm saying this is a 14-story building, and it's potentially going to go up. I mean, I don't know. I mean, who knows? I'm totally dubious of the financing of this project, especially after that really revealing, I think, Observer article that said they had $18,000 in the bank. And then when they asked this... And then you get, you know, the spokesman for the Park 51 project is saying... He won't rule out raising money abroad, even from Iran. And I saw that interview to a certain extent. So the irony is that people are saying, well, we'd like to see where the financing comes from. Well, they can't see it because there is no financing yet.
But that doesn't stop people
then
from
this,
saying they're financed
argument.
By
so then
extremists.
It comes down to, like, okay, so who is Imam Roof, who, in his own words, you know, wants to build this to is a point of healing between the Muslim world and the West? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jeffrey Goldberg posted something that was very persuasive. He was at some Daniel Pearl Memorial where he said, I'm a Jew, and if it means loving God or something like that.
He said the Shema. He said the Shema.
Yeah, okay, he said the Shema. And then, you know, but then, if I may, you know, in June 2009, an issue that I care very much about, Imam Rauf gave his advice to President Obama as to what to do with with Iran, and I can quote this here because I pulled it up and put it on my Word document. He says, speaking of Obama, he should say his administration respects many of the guiding principles of the 1979 revolution to establish a government that expresses the will of the people, a just government based on the idea of Vilayat al-Faqih that establishes the rule of law. And this is, in my opinion, despite his admirable comments at the Daniel Pearl Memorial and his admirable views on suicide bombing and the murder of innocents, this is a sinister thing to do. Because, you know, Adam, I'm sure you would agree with me that in June 2009, after the fraudulent elections, when you had hundreds of thousands of Iranians supporting the Green Movement on the streets, one of the central issues between the government of Iran and the protesters was the ability of the supreme leader to essentially nullify a free election, which mm-hmm. is an idea that is enshrined in Vilayat al-Faqih. And here's this, you know, Sufi imam in America urging the president to basically take the side of Supreme Leader Khamenei. At least that's how I read it. It's on his website, so I mean, maybe I'm reading it wrong. But I'm not as convinced that Raouf, and then you combine that with his kind of equivocating remarks about, you know, did foreign policy bring on 9/11? When this is again not an Islamist view, it's like a Chomskyan like left wing nonsense view, and you know, so stuff like that, which I would say
I don't know if it's so. Sorry, go ahead.
So it's something like, now does this bear on his property rights or the permit process? Absolutely not. I mean, I start off saying that, you know, that I don't believe that the government should infringe on that. But I think this does speak to whether or not Raouf is, in the words of Jeff Goldberg, you know, I mean, is there some space between being, I mean, I can think of better sentiments. Or forget better sentiments, and I just find that this is a fairly politically noxious view to have of his.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of my problems, really, is that when we talk about Muslims who have, you know, who have what you would describe as crackpot views, those crackpot views somehow make them more dangerous than regular people who have crackpot views. Like, frankly, you know, I don't think it's so fringe to say that American policy, foreign policy, had something to do with 9/11. That's in the 9/11 Commission report. I mean, I think the way that he expressed it.
Was that an interview right after the attacks?
Well, that interview has been butchered. I mean, what he said was that terrorism has no place in Islam, and the only thing that they quote from that interview is the part where he's like, Bin Laden was made in the USA. And you know, U.S. is an accessory to 9/11, which I assume was a reference to, you know, the U.S. supporting the Islamist revolution against the Soviets in the 80s, which I think is I wouldn't have made that criticism in the way that he made it, but I think is a fair point. I don't think it points to what I don't think is that, and I would also disagree with his statements on Iran, but I don't think that indicates from him a level of sort of malevolence towards the United States. I mean, broadly speaking, Spencer Ackerman wrote a piece in 2005 about how American sort of public religiosity had a sort of prophylactic effect against Islamist radicalism in the United States. I mean, this is a guy who, generally speaking, has been, you know, worked very hard to sort of give the impression that there's nothing contradictory between being a Muslim and being an American. And I think that it's sort of, you know, we rarely do this with other people, which is we say, you know, we may take their statements out of context, but we rarely take their statements out of context and then we conclude, oh, this man supports terrorism. I mean, that's
first of all, I didn't say that. I started. I mean, if you remember,
no, you didn't say that. But I mean,
I prefaced my remarks of my disappointment about his, you know, June 2009. Advice to Obama by saying he has been very clear on terrorism and, you know, noting what he said in the Daniel Pearl Memorial. And I don't think that you can make any argument at this point based on what we know about Raouf that his mosque would be like Darul Hijra in Falls Church, which is a mosque where there clearly was a current of radical terrorism. And, you know, I mean, and this, like, then leads me to this other point. I mean, Listen, I'm probably not, like, the best person to have, because I'm not going to give you a full-throated, they shouldn't build the mosque. I'm just saying that I'm not going to presage, just because I am unoffended or unmoved by this Islamic center being built two blocks from Ground Zero, does not mean that, like, oh, I could see how Deborah Burlingame, who lost her brother in the attacks, would be offended by it, and I don't find her her political ad or the sentiment that she's expressing, which is that it's just wrong, I wish you'd find another site, or what the Howard Dean position, I suppose, is, to be sinister or in that sense, like, you know, they have to build it. I don't feel like a sense, how do I put this, Adam? This is going to sound, I'm not really trying to be Weasley, but let me put it this. I don't feel like I need to support the building of this mosque because I need to show solidarity with Imam Rauf. I don't really believe that. I'm against the shenanigans with this landmarking process and questioning his rights, his property rights. I'm not questioning that he's an American. I'm not questioning that there are Americans who are going to worship there. But at the same time, I can also understand that there's these other people who are saying, hey, you know, we're offended.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
you know, that's that.
Well, I'll say this. I don't think people... I mean, I think for my purposes, I'm not invested in the mosque being built or not built. I mean, I think I'm just personally invested in the mosque, the project not being defeated as a result of a bunch of people screaming about how the guy running it, you know, hates America and wants to subvert the United States. I mean, sure, you know, Deborah Burlingame lost a family member on 9/11, and that sort of loss needs to be respected, but at the same time, that doesn't give her the right to go on Fox News with Robert Spencer and say, you know, and agree that Rauf is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, or his dad is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He's not even the right denomination, and his dad was working for the government in the Egyptian government in the United States at the time of a Brotherhood crackdown. I mean, like, they didn't even ask him about that. That's just something that sort of this got plucked out of the ether. I mean, I think I'm invested, and I think this is where it gets to the sort of culture war question, is I'm invested in the idea that Americans not respond to every sort of public discussion involving Muslims with this sort of hysterical fear, right? Because I think it's really bad for American society to do that. And I think I would ask the same
courtesy on the American left when it comes to neoconservatives, but go on, yes.
one of the things, when it comes to the culture war, though, I mean, this is one of the things that's really started to bother me. And you look at this sort of Pew poll where people say, you know, people who tend to disapprove of Obama's performance are more likely to believe that he's a Muslim. I mean, I think that's really disturbing. And I think, you know, if you look at the Washington Times today, you have two articles basically suggest. I mean, one says Obama is a cultural Muslim, and there's this very much.
Is this in the opinion section?
Huh? This is the opinion section, right?
All right. Well, I'm sorry. Okay. I read for the front page.
I'm sorry for not making that distinction clear. Right. In the opinion section, there's a picture of Obama with like a crescent on his cheek, and there's just this sort of, you know, there's just this flood, and I think people were waiting for this. I think this is why the whole issue got nationalized in the first place, is Republicans really wanted the president to speak up about it, because now they get to say, look, Obama cares about Muslims more than the United States. And this whole, like, America versus Muslims dichotomy and this political tendency to use Muslims or Islam as sort of a political weapon to make liberals look out of touch or whatever, which is something that conservatives do all the time. But which I think becomes particularly harmful when you try to use an entire group of people as a sort of political weapon in that sense. I think that's what bothers me.
I think that the political sense of it is simply that it was bound to divide the Democrats if you made this mosque a national issue. And, you know, to quote George W. Bush, mission accomplished. I mean, in the sense that you do now have Harry Reid, Howard Dean, and lots of other Democrats running who are basically taking the same side as Deborah Burlingame. It's unclear the muddle of what Obama is trying to say about the mosque. I mean, he's asserting that they have a right to build it. He's asserting that Muslims have a right to worship freely in the United States, which I believes an uncontroversial issue across both parties. Well, no, I really do. But then he's asked specifically, so do you have an opinion about whether they should build the mosque? And he says, I wasn't talking about that. And then, you know, as you know, there's the famous, you know, we weren't backing down email blast from Bill Burton. So the truth of the matter is that this is an issue that is tying up the Democratic Party in knots. And the reason it's tying up the Democratic Party in knots is because they are the party in power. And it's easy to take unrealistic and crazy poses when you're the party out of power. You don't have to, I mean, if you're Newt Gingrich, it's not on you if we screw up the war in Afghanistan because we've failed to persuade, you know, I don't know, local Pashtuns to side with NATO as opposed to something else. You know what I'm saying?
No, I agree with you. And I think you saw something similar with the Biports world.
Yeah, well, the Democrats were out of power then. Right, exactly. And the Democrats, it doesn't hurt them. It's no skin off their back. And it's
I'm making that argument, but what I'm saying is that I think that I don't really care which party is doing it. I just think it's really bad when you sort of use, like, when Muslim becomes like a way to describe someone that you don't like. I mean, that's when it becomes sort of a political
thing. I think you're making a bit of a leap. Now, I'm not going to deny that the comments from Newt Gingrich were absolutely horrible. I mean, like, you know, comparing Islam to Nazism is just wrong. And so, you know, I think they're arguing that this is too close to this hallowed ground. I don't like hallowed ground arguments, but that's different than saying I don't like Muslims and they shouldn't worship freely. And it also, I think, is an elision of a more difficult conversation, Adam, that I don't know that we've had yet, which is, when is it appropriate to monitor a mosque, or for that matter, an Islamist website? When is it appropriate to oppose a mosque? I mean, like, I guess I could imagine, though, a situation where if there was a Finsbury Park, you know about Finsbury Park, right?
Mm-hmm.
In London, right? Which is a famous hub of Al-Qaeda, right? Openly, you know, you have people in this mosque who are openly preaching at the time against, you know, the British government. It was almost kind of a form of sedition. And so my question is, okay, that's not the mainstream of Islam. But it is something that we might have to deal with. When is it appropriate to look at the extracurricular activities of someone like Hassan Nadal, an army major who's a psychologist who's dealing with people with trauma? Well, I mean, I don't know the answer to that. But that's a hard question. Because now asking what the government ought to do, and now we're getting into whereas I think this whole Park 51 Cordoba House, Adam, is a fake issue. It's just a proxy for a bunch of nuanced and hard conversations that we're not having, and so people pose on either side.
I'd say it's not a fake issue. I think I think the fact that it's a proxy doesn't mean it's doesn't mean it's fake. You know what I mean? Like, I think by definition it means, you know, there's something substantive that we need to be talking about here. Two things. I will say, I mean, it's not just Gingrich. I mean, you see Rush Limbaugh calling Obama Imam Obama, and there's the whole, you know,
Obama.
Yeah, he called him Imam Obama, and he said he was pandering to Muslim votes.
Who doesn't do that, by the way, is Mark Levin. Just want to point that out.
Yes.
He does not pander in that way.
But I think my problem is I'm, you know, I think those questions of when it's appropriate to bug a mosque and when it's to surveil these institutions, I don't think those are really conversations. And I may sound a little elitist here. I don't think those are conversations for amateurs. Like, honestly, like, I see Spencer walking around trying to oppose every mosque construction, trying to draw, you know, go through Steve Emerson's databases and try to find whatever, like, thin reed of radicalism he can find But, I mean, like, I think that's a job for the FBI, and it's a job for the Treasury Department. But I think that, you know, when we start having these conversations, what it devolves into is hysteria because everybody, you know, starts thinking of themselves as an anti-jihadist vigilante. What they're really doing is they're just sort of making things harder for regular people who wouldn't have a quarrel with them at all.
Okay, but Adam, if I may sharpen the point on this, we almost saw with Abdulmutallab, Hassan Nadal, and then later this
Nadal Hassan.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm sorry, Nadal Hassan, and then later this guy in Times Square. We've seen what has been what I think we could say are, you know, very close near misses, and what would be intelligence or counterterrorism failures. And so then that is those sorts of incidents, I think, push to a political conversation. Why is the FBI not doing its job, and what do we need to? And so we live in a democracy, whether we like it or not. Sometimes those things are conversations that people want to have. Now, we have not had, really, it hasn't become a big national issue. What ought we do about this? Because there are some fairly ugly things and hard calls that you want the government to make that, you know, people would like to not get into, I think. But it's becoming to the point where as I said before, this is not me saying that, and therefore we need to do more to monitor America's mosques, 1900 mosques. I'm not necessarily saying that. A lot of these mosques have cooperated with the FBI against radical factions, including Dar al-Hijra, the mosque that featured Anwar al-Awlaki.
Including Ralph.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, did Dar al-Hijra feature Ralph at one point?
Ralph helped the FBI reach out to the Muslim community after 9/11.
Right. So, I'm saying, complicated questions. But I kind of feel like because there wasn't really a moment where people were having that kind of conversation before, that this pent-up stuff again gets sort of funneled into this question of this mosque, which is fraught with all the symbolism.
I agree with you. Yeah. I think that there's a certain kind of conversation that needs to happen, and I've actually written about this. What really bothers me is that liberals are very afraid of having a conversation about domestic radicalism.
Yeah.
And what happens is when you don't have conversations about these things, they do bubble up. I mean, that's the only reason why you're seeing this sort of explosion right now is because we haven't had a reasonable public discourse on it. In part because, you know, liberals have been afraid to have one, and at the moment, conservatives are invested in making the Democrats look bad as possible, so they're perfectly happy, as you said, to say nutty things, just like some Democrats were when they were in the minority. But what I will say about this is, you know, is from a national security standpoint. I mean, you mentioned three people. You mentioned Abdulmutallab. You mentioned Major Nidal Hassan, and you mentioned Faisal Shahzad.
Right.
And I think we've talked about Anwar al-Awlaki, who's played like an outsized role in sort of recruiting these types of, westernized Muslims. And what's really disturbing about al-Awlaki is that his pitch is specifically, you know, he's constantly saying America will turn on you, America doesn't care about you, America doesn't consider you to be American. And then you have this whole sort of segment on the right that's growing more influential saying pretty much the exact same thing. I mean, like, that's frightening. I mean, Ali Soufan, who's an FBI agent, a former FBI interrogator, who's Lebanese-American, spoke Arabic, supposedly one of the most skilled interrogators in the FBI, you know, was one of eight Arabic speakers in the FBI when 9/11 hit.
I know who Ali Soufan
is. You know, he said Osama bin Laden's next sort of jihadist commercial has already been cut, and it's about the Cordoba House. I think that's a real problem, and I think there's.
Well, let me just.
I think we could talk about this without.
Yeah, let me stop you right there.
Okay.
I don't like this. I do not like it. I don't like this mode of argument. I don't like it when it's done the right on the left, that, you know, when you say what you're going to say in our domestic debate, you're emboldening the terrorists, and I don't like it when the left does it to the right, saying everything you're doing. I feel that I'm completely skeptical of public opinion polling in most of the Islamic world, because there is no right to privacy, really, and the government listens to phone calls, as we know from this latest thing with BlackBerry RIM. And the United Arab Emirates and other in Saudi Arabia, they want to be able to basically listen to these conversations unfettered. So I've always wondered about how much candor somebody answering a landline in Cairo or Riyadh, you know what I'm saying, has when asked about anything. I mean, I'm just saying. So that's my first issue. There are right. other ways of measuring.
I'm not talking about Cairo or Riyadh. I'm talking about the U.S.
Okay. Now let's talk about in the U.S., and I just think that the process of radicalization is extremely complicated and personalized and localized.
Yes.
So, you know, why did Adam Gadon cross over? Do you know what I'm saying? Was it because he was listening to death metal music? And you can really, if you look at the individual cases of Americans we know who have joined Al-Qaeda, you find, I think, you know, I don't think it's, you know, because there's a calculation that, hey, I'm never going to be an American. I think that these people are already fringe losers in society. They're looking for a new support network, similar to somebody who might join a gang.
Right.
And, like, these are, you know, and it's a very, very thorny problem that I would hate for us to get into a habit of saying that, like, we blame the rhetoric of one side of the debate for doing that, because I just don't think, I don't see it. You know?
No, I don't think that's not what I was trying to say. Obviously, okay. Radicalization is a really complex right. process, and there's no one thing that makes this happen. Like but I mean, I do think that there's, you know, that there's a certain, like, I think it's going to be a formative experience for some young Muslims in America, that we had a summer where we debated whether there should be a mosque exclusion zone near the World Trade Center. I think that's a real problem. I don't think it's one thing to say, you know, I'm not trying to say, you know,
yeah.
if you talk about Islam like this, you know, the terrorists, when you're betraying the country. I think there's a way to have that conversation about how it's, in what way it's in the United States' interest to talk about terrorism without saying you're sort of actively trying to undermine. What I am saying is that I don't think that sort of discourse is very helpful, even from a national security point of view. Particularly since, you know, the sort of agreed upon approach among the people who are on the front lines of this fight is to isolate Al-Qaeda, not to brand them with the broader legitimacy of Islam as a whole.
Well, but there, I mean, I also would just point out that there have been a number of Muslims who have opposed the mosque site, saying it was, you know, needlessly controversial, and... I mean, I don't profess to have data, but there was, you know, the one woman who was who wrote for an op-ed for the Washington Post about 2 weeks ago, who is Muslim, who said that she found the project to be offensive to her. There have been other groups of kind of what I guess opposed to this ex-Muslim movement, which are somewhat radical in the other direction, who've opposed it as well. So I mean, I don't necessarily. I mean, like, I think that you could come at it from a different perspective. I was having a debate with an email exchange with somebody who was sort of talking about, are Republicans alienating as just a voter, forget for a second radicalization, are they alienating as voters, like the Bengali software engineer who's going to look at the Republicans and say, you guys just hate Muslims? And then the question is, well, maybe the Bengali software engineer is just like, you know, I'm not fooled, you know, I know how this project is going to be perceived in the Muslim world, and they have every... I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm saying that I could see it coming out either way.
I think what you're talking about is actually indicative of a trend I really hate in American political discourse, and yeah. it's the same sort of impulse that leads every news station to go and ask Al Sharpton a question there's a controversy involving race, which is like you ask one person for like the Muslim perspective or the black perspective or the female perspective. And they're supposed to represent this, you know. I didn't see that op-ed, but if that woman was offended, fine. I mean, I just think that, you know, whether you're offended or not, there's a broader set of political conversation in which, you know, to be associated with Islam is bad. That certainly isn't the fault of the Republican Party. I mean, if you look at that Economist poll, suspicion of Islam is widespread. In the United States, and suspicion of Muslims is widespread. But I think the job of politicians should be not to indulge that kind of hysteria. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have a conversation.
I want to get back to your point about Al Sharpton, though. The point I was trying to make is that you were saying, well, you know, what about the Muslim who would see this and then become radicalized? And my point was just almost kind of echoing exactly what you were saying, which is that I would imagine there is a diverse amount of opinion in this American Muslim community. you can find people on both sides of the debate on this particular Cordoba House initiative. And that's my only point, which is to say that, in fact, you're right. There isn't a monolithic view. There are probably plenty of Muslims who, in this country, who agree with Deborah Burlingame.
I think it depends. I think you could find a lot of Muslims who probably wish the whole thing would go away and wish it had never come up in the first place.
Or, and by the way, the people the people most guilty of trying to speak for all the Muslims are, like, CARE and these groups, you know what I'm saying, kind of professionally, like, who speak, like Ibrahim Huber.
But everybody needs advocacy groups, right? And that's an imperfect system because they can't represent everybody. But, you know, I mean, like, you know, you have the best way is to have more than one advocacy group, right?
Agreed. The CARE has not been forthcoming with, like, where they get their money from. And if they're getting their money from foreign forces, that's relevant. But I agree.
That's everybody a different needs question.
Groups. You raised an interesting point, or you were getting to you're sort of getting into this as we get to the end of the dialogue. You were talking about the Economist poll, right?
And right. The Economist 80%, poll.
Like 80% are either somewhat or very view Islam somewhat or very disfavorably, right?
Right.
And then I think the Democrats are not that better. In fact, I think there were more less than 30% of Democrats supported the Cordoba House initiative. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
In that Economist poll. Now, so what does that poll say to you about favorable, less favorable? What does that poll say to you? Because I read it, you know, before we did this, and I wanted to get. But first, what do you think?
I think it says that people are very suspicious. Americans are very suspicious and scared of Muslims, and I think that has to do with one big thing, which is that Islam has taken a really important role in our political conversation, but most people don't know any Muslims at all, let alone very well. And I think that contributes to a sort of sense of suspicion and fear about Muslims and Islam in general.
Because, I mean, I wonder if I was to take a poll of, like, I don't know, New York Economist readers, okay? What do you think of the Catholic Church in the height of, like, all the sex scandals and so forth, right? I'm serious. And remember at the time, like, you know, Christopher Hitchens is writing scathing columns. My favorite comedian, David Cross, has got this bit about, you know, the Catholic Church has just gotten a whole lot sexier. You know what I'm saying? So that's a situation. Catholics have been in this country, or more established in this country, certainly than Muslims. So I'm not denying that. They are, but, like, if you saw people saying, you know, I don't have a very favorable view of Muslims because, you know, they keep reading all these stories about, you know, I don't know, pedophilia in the Catholic Church. And yet, at the same time, I'm sure they would also say, if you were to ask them in the poll, do you think all Catholics support pedophilia? They would say, no, of course not. But this is something that was done in the name of the Catholic Church, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my question, my point about this is this. I totally agree. The vast majority of Muslims reject the terrorism of Al-Qaeda and so forth. But nonetheless, these people who are, if nothing else, really adamant about how Muslim they are, commit these atrocities. So the casual observer, I mean, I'm saying, is this a reflection of, like, deep-seated jingoism on the part of American Republicans or Americans that they just don't, you know, they just don't like foreigners and it's their fault? Or is it because of the casual observer is asked a question, favorable or unfavorable, and they have in their mind these people who kind of go on and on about how Muslim they are, who commit these atrocities, even though if they gave it a second thought, they would realize that these are not speaking or they shouldn't be speaking for everybody else.
No, I think it's a mistake sometimes to sort of attribute mass opinion to malice.
Okay.
I think sometimes when I talk about prejudice, people don't understand that I'm not actually necessarily ascribing malice. If malice was required for prejudice, then prejudice wouldn't be very about anything wouldn't be very widespread because people can't be angry all the time.
Sure.
What I'm saying is that I think a lot of people don't know very many Muslims. I think when they hear about Muslims, they hear about violence committed by Muslims, and I think that as a result, you know, there's not much of a counter narrative that they're hearing. Because there aren't really that many Muslims in America. I mean, there are more, I think there are actually more Jews than Muslims in America. And so as a result, there's sort of, I think they just don't know what to think. And it is, I think there's a poll that maybe 40% of Americans admit to having some sort of prejudice towards Muslims. I mean, that's, that's a real problem, but I think it's not reflective of, you know, Americans being particularly malicious. I think this is a pretty human tendency to sort of, when you, you know, it's a heuristic. When you don't understand something, you sort of develop a, or you don't know very much about something, you sort of develop a very simple system for understanding it. Mm-hmm. And I think given what's happened over the past few years and the way we've talked about Muslims and people's exposure to Muslims and the fact that a lot of people don't know any Muslims, I think that conclusion is rational. I just think it's also very disturbing.
I don't think it's particularly deep. And I wonder in these polls where they say favorable or unfavorable, you know what I'm saying? It's like you're forced to pick one, where maybe a more accurate would be just sort of studied indifference.
No, but there's a sort of I don't know in there.
Right. Okay. I'm not justifying it. Back to the original question, are we at war? Is there a cultural war? I mean, you say over Islam. I mean, it seems like, yeah, in the last month, it has become a major national issue, in part because President Obama and Mayor Bloomberg have gotten involved. Probably that was a mistake, I think, on their part, not just politically, but it should have been left as not a political issue. I will concede there's a danger with when political leaders exploit things in such a way. But I wanted to ask you this as sort of ending. You know, what we're seeing right now, I mean, we never saw there was predicted backlash, violent backlash after 9/11 against American Muslims. It didn't really materialize. We haven't seen statistically, you know, increases in violent incidents yet, though, according to Bobby Ghosh and what I think was a subpar cover story on Is America Islamophobic, he suggests that there's more anecdotal evidence of that now. So, of course, that's pretty nasty. But, like, how does this compare? I mean, like, I don't know. Adam, 35 years ago, there were white Irish Catholics in Boston literally throwing bricks through the windows of school buses that had black school children because they were integrating the schools. You want to talk about an ugly, xenophobic kind of mob mentality moment in American, you know, 1975 in Boston, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does this compare to those kinds of, or the internment of Japanese Americans? I'm saying these are the clearly examples of awful American behavior mm-hmm. in this mob mentality. Right.
I think it's always important to look at this stuff in context, and I think you're right. You know, on the one hand, you're absolutely right that there was a spike shortly after 9/11 of bias crimes directed at Muslims and Sikhs, but you're right in the sense that we haven't seen a broad Islamophobic backlash of the scale of which people were predicting, and in part because the Bush administration was pretty responsible rhetorically in managing it. But I think that it's one thing to say, you know, this isn't as bad as the race riots of yesteryear or the internment of Japanese Americans. But I don't think it's necessarily a standard we should hold ourselves to. I think any time in which the two political parties are arguing over which party loves Muslims more, I think it's a problem. I don't think it's, you know, obviously it's not Marchers in Selma problem.
Is that what they're doing, or there are some people who are clearly that's what they have in mind, okay? And you mentioned Imam Obama and Rush Limbaugh and stuff like that. Okay, fair enough, all right? But, I mean, I'm just asking, like, can you avoid getting into that really toxic debate, but still say, it's wrong to build a mosque there, it's wrong to build an Islamic center there, it's offensive to the memories of the victims and the families of the victims, they shouldn't do it. Like, is that position the equivalent, or is that a stand-in for Obama just likes Muslims more than Americans? Which I agree with you is a really nasty and awful thing to sentiment to stoke. Do you see what I'm saying?
I mean, I think the broader American position is, I mean, like, is not Obama loves Muslims more than Americans. I think it's, you know, this is offensive to me because, you know, Muslims did this. But I think that conclusion is inherently problematic because it says that Americans are associating, you know, the deeds of Al-Qaeda with mainstream Muslims. And I think even if it's not necessarily buying into the sort of vilest form of that narrative, it's still a little scary.
Okay, but I guess it strikes me that don't build the mosque there. It's offensive to lots of people. Is categorically different than this other nastier stuff. And that I would not look at them as one and the same. And that if the debate is just on something like that, like saying, you know what, just as I think Howard Dean expressed it, which was, I really think let's try to work it out. This is too, you know, this is too politically sensitive right now. Let's find a suitable alternative location. His position is substantively the same as Deborah Burlingame's, but it's, I think, I think that, you know, what he's saying is, and the way he expressed it is very different than what I would point out as really kind of stoking the uglier kind of sentiments against American Muslims, and, you know, not like we could compare or should compare the our republic to the unfree societies in the Middle East, but, you know, the response that the governments like Iran or Saudi Arabia on these questions are really actively encouraging, I think, hatred of America, hatred of Jews and that sort of thing, and infidels and so forth.
Yeah, I think it's wrong. I think it's a bad idea to hold ourselves to
that standard. And I'm not doing that. I'm not doing it. I'm just saying, to put in perspective, Islamic countries, okay, that support a lot of the kind of, you know, funding for mosques and Islamic education materials are quite open and, you know, have crossed numerous thresholds in making it clear that of their view of non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
In our country, we have maybe the beginning of people who are trying to exploit this nasty sentiment. I join mm-hmm. you in sort of saying, okay, stop right there. I also think that there are lots of people who just are offended, don't mean ill will to Muslims, just want to say, just don't build the Cordoba house there. And I think we also are hoping, I'm assuming that, I'm sensing that we agree that that is not the same as some of the other stuff, right?
I would say a couple of things. Number mm-hmm. one, I remember you mentioning the sort of 13-story thing. I think the number is the Cordoba house would be the 2,000-something
right.
Tallest building in New York. Like, 13 stories is not a
I agree.
But
before there was a monument to the world, I mean, it would be completed before there was a monument to Ground Zero.
Right.
Which is
but that's, I mean, that's New York's fault. That's not,
okay,
that's
sure.
not the Cordoba okay. Initiative's
fair
fault.
Enough.
But, I think you sort of to say, you know, people are offended by this. One is, I think they wouldn't be as offended if this hadn't been successfully ginned into a national issue. I mean, I think there's an alternate universe in which this whole thing went down and this building was built and nobody batted an eyelash. The second thing is if you say that it's offensive for this space to be there, you sort of have to deal with the next logical question, which is, what do you do about the two masjids that are already within five blocks of the World Trade Center? I mean, do you say, you know, this is a Muslim-free zone, and I don't know how you, do you clear these people out now? I mean, like, why is their prior presence there any less offensive if it's offensive for Muslims to be there? Why is it any less offensive?
But see, the argument is not that it's offensive for Muslims to be there. The argument is it's offensive to build this, you know, fairly large structure that, you know, would be maybe completed before there would be a memorial for the victims of 9/11. And again, not my argument, but I think that is the view of the people who are saying we find this particular building to be offensive. I mean, I think the argument went with the Carmelite covenant that was near Auschwitz or something, and then the Pope said don't build it, and it was not a legal argument ultimately in Germany that prevailed. It was rather just a sense of like, well, you know, this is, again, I'm not comparing. Well, first of all, that's a Catholic covenant. It's not the Nazis, so I'm not even saying. But it's saying that it's just a matter of, you know, taking into account the sensitivities of a population. And I guess from my perspective, it's like,
no, but I mean, I think there's another argument there also.
If you want to say you shouldn't be offended by Deborah Burlingame, I mean, go ahead. I'm tend to sort of say I respect the potency of your emotion without saying that you feel this way and your sense of that you're not doing this just because you want to try to uncork or unleash this anti-Muslim sentiment in the country politically.
Well, two things. I would say that, you know, I could also understand why some Jews would find that offensive, if only because of the sort of relative inaction of the Catholic Church in the face of the Holocaust,
yeah.
Which is a completely separate question.
Okay.
But I think that's, I mean, I think that's I mean, the inaction of, and that's different because we're talking about a centralized, the leader of a centralized organization mm-hmm. not doing something as opposed to, you know, simply like lay Catholics building, you know, what I will say also is that I think Burlingame is maybe not the best example because, you know, she did say, I mean, she told Politico that Western, freedom of religion was a Western concept, which I think, you know,
well,
going back to sort of the question of Saudi Arabia and like all these other countries that are incredibly repressive towards religious minorities, I don't think you teach them justice or tolerance by imitating, even on a small scale, whatever it is that they do. I think you teach them tolerance and justice by being tolerant and just.
We're not doing anything like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia.
No, we're not.
We're nothing like. But I'm saying if they don't. Having people say it's offensive, don't build a mosque, is nothing. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, it's not really comparable. Listen, Newt Gingrich has said a lot of rhetorically sloppy and stupid things, okay? So when he, I mean, I'm not, I'm not going to defend him. I'm not going to defend what Pamela Geller mm-hmm. writes on her blog. Yeah, you're right. There's an element of people who are really exploiting this stuff. But there's a lot of other people, Republicans, conservatives, and Democrats now, it turns out.
Yes.
Who are just simply saying, just don't build it there. And I just don't think that that needs to be, and I guess my whole point here is that is not, whether or not this mosque gets built, or rather the opposition to this mosque, is not de facto the equivalent of stoking this very ugly sentiment. Now, if it turns out we move on from the mosque controversy, but we still have Republicans criticizing the president for, I don't know, I mean, like I could see an ad that spliced out of context various things that he said in his Cairo speech.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, I'm just thinking off the top of my head. All right, well, then, yeah, that's a problem if you start, you know, you start kind of seeing that this becomes the major issue for the Republicans. I don't think it will be in September. I think that they want to talk about, you know, the economy and jobs, but, you know, maybe I'm wrong. And insofar, and I would also say, I agree with you, insofar as political national leaders have a responsibility not to kind of give validation to ugly, kind of bigoted sentiments and so forth. Yeah, I agree. There's a responsibility to being political leaders. Yes. But I just am saying that on this mosque issue, I don't know that that a lot of it is just irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. I would say that, I would just repeat what I said before, that I think that the opposition isn't necessarily indicative of malice, but I think it is indicative of a broader suspicion and negative views about Muslims and Islam that I think is a serious social problem. It's not Alabama in the 1960s, but it's something we have to deal with responsibly. And I don't actually see either side of the aisle dealing with it very responsibly at the moment.
All right, with that, so if there was a cultural war against Islam, what would be the theme song?
I don't know. I'm guessing something by Common or Mos Def. I mean,
Rock the Casbah, The Clash. That's what I think. Anyway.
Right, of course, but, you know, so, talk about sensitivity.
Or, right, or, right, you were going to like, for Umi Says by Mos Def.
Oh, there we go. I mean, I don't know.
There was a review of The New Danger by Mos Def, which was not as good as Black on Both Sides or his earlier work, and the title of the review, I forget where it was What Would Umi Say?
Oh, that's pretty good. I think, actually, my favorite Mos Def song ever is on True Magic, and it's just, it's one of the most poetic songs I've ever heard, but that album as a whole is just really terrible. I mean, it's not really an album.
What is the name of the song on True Magic? Because
I forget. It's the one where he uses his iPod as a metaphor. He brings in his iPod 7-Eleven God and Dunkin' Donuts in like this huge like mixed metaphor, a conceit that I actually can't remember off the top of my head at the moment.
My favorite Mos track is Hip Hop off of Black on Both Sides, which I think is
really
maybe the most poetic hip hop rap song. I mean, it's just, it's brilliant.
So I have a question for you about hip hop. Does it, now do the politics of people like, you know, like Mosdef, who's obviously like extremely pro-Palestinian, does that bother you when you listen
Mosdef's
to
Mosdef's politics to definitely bother me on a number of levels. I mean, Mosdef is a 9/11 truther, and it's extremely problematic that Mosdef's politics are so daft, because I really do believe that at a certain point when he was in Black Star with Taleb, it's some of the best hip-hop that's ever been made, in my opinion. I mean, I put him up there with Nas and Rakim and Biggie and Tupac. So, you know, I'm a fan of his work aesthetically, and I think his politics are toxic. And, you know, also, like, he goes on radio shows, Adam, and says this garbage about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And how he doesn't know. I mean, like, it's like poisoning the minds of people who look up to him in some ways. I don't want to say, so yes, it's a huge problem with Mosdef. And if I ever met Mosdef, I mean, I've thought about this. I mean, like, how would I express to him, like, how much admiration I have for his music and how little and how much contempt I have for his politics?
I think that, I mean, it's sort of, I remember when I was younger, I mean, there's a weird thing that happens with hip-hop when you sort of grow up and you realize, and you start to, I think, understand better the political references in hip-hop music. You sort of realize that someone can be incredibly talented and poetic and intelligent and just have the worst politics imaginable.
Well, it's interesting,
especially
because,
when it comes to...
I mean, like, Moses is actually unique, right? Because he's brilliant, obviously. I mean, he's a really smart guy. And his politics are very suspicious and critical, as Common was for a while, of, you know, the kind of, you know, gangster, lawless capitalism and sexism, right? I mean, like, he's come out against a lot of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the thing about Mosdef is that, you know, he's right. It veered in this conspiratorial direction. Whereas, you know, I kind of consider Jay-Z to be really a free market conservative in some ways.
I think that free market conservatism is basically, I mean, a kind of cutthroat free market conservatism is the preeminent political philosophy of hip-hop music.
Basically, right. I mean, during the 2008 campaign, I thought that one of the things that, besides that McCain could do is sort of make an appeal to the hip-hop community, saying, listen, only one candidate in this election has been incarcerated.
Well, look, I will say the hip-hop mirrors the Republican Party in one other sense, is that, you know, it may talk a good game on free market capitalism, but I think generally speaking, efforts to minimize government, especially when we're talking about the social safety net, would be unpopular with large segments of the hip-hop audience.
Yeah.
Americans like small government broadly. I think Americans like the rhetoric of small government broadly, and that's reflected in hip hop, and sometimes people sort of try to sever hip hop culturally from the rest of the United States. But I think hip hop is in many ways a reflection of many different culturally conservative trends in American culture, not just free market conservatism.
Well, yeah, hip hop valorizes individuals who, against all odds, make excessive amounts of money and do so, you know, in a somewhat cutthroat and vicious way. And
it's also very gendered.
Yeah, right. So that is, if there is such a thing, more of a conservative narrative than what you would consider to be like a great kind of liberal narrative, or a liberal hero would be this sort of, I don't know, like, you don't see many rappers, you know, rapping about how, you know, they left the hood and joined the Peace Corps and, you know, helped teach a, you know...
I'd say Lupe Fiasco would be an exception to this rule, and then I think his politics are actually very interesting and explicitly not sort of part of...
Like I said on an earlier dialogue, there's not many raps about community gardens.
Right. Right. And I mean, I think in general there are a few rappers who really sort of display any... like complex understanding of international politics in the way that Lupe does.
Well, didn't you?
And I think that has a lot to do with.
We'll end it at this, but didn't Nas? I'm trying to remember. There was some Nas track where he was saying how we needed to open up to lift trade restrictions with Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
I mean Nas. I've pretty much I mean, I gave up on Nazis politics sometimes in grade school.
I just think,
I mean, he's brilliant. He's an incredible poet and rapper, but I don't even read his interviews because I just can't deal with it.
Right. He's like an AIDS. He's an AIDS conspiracist. Right. You're right.
But to bring it back,
it's actually true. Like, the actual politics of most rappers are atrocious. Though I do feel that if we could have Jay-Z in the room, like, you know, Marshall McLuhan in the Woody Allen movie, I think like his politics would be largely corporatist.
I think you're probably right. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, when he compares to where his career would be if he was Talib Kweli and where he is now, he'd make the same choice because he wants to make money. I mean, I think that's just about everything you need to know. Although I'd say what's interesting about Jay-Z is he's not unapologetically corporatist. I think the most consistent theme in his music is the tension between what you need and what you should do and what you want to do. And I think that's part of what makes him so interesting, because that's a perennial human conflict, right? I mean, we're always struggling with the
It's like having Coke in the trunk and cops in the rearview mirror, right?
Well, in an abstract sense, I'd say.
All right. This was very good. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I guess there's going to be, like, at the end of the dialogue, like, there's going to be a whole discussion, right? We're going to have a whole discussion about, like, the war in Islam and the mosque. And then there's, like, you know, 10 minutes on hip-hop, which is great with me.
Well, just to bring it back, I think Lupe's politics are very much informed, or his sort of, like, understanding of global politics are very much informed by the fact that he's a Muslim.
Is Lupe Fiasco a Muslim?
Yes. Yes, he is. I mean, if you listen to his music, you can hear, I mean, there's one song where he goes through sort of, the theme of the song is sort of how different societies prepare children for violence. So he goes from the perspective of a child soldier in a Muslim country to, you know, kids playing video games at home to, you know, like Columbine, who sort of go on a Columbine-like spree. And I think at the beginning there's a kid who robs a liquor store or something. I mean, it's a really fascinating sort of exploration of the way in which he sees societies socializing children for violence. But it's global in a way.
I'm
going to
put down my Jewel Santana records, and I'm going to listen to some music.
Well, I'll send you the song.
I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
Anyway, it's great talking to you, as usual. And I guess we 3, 2, 1 or something? Or do we have to
No. Later, man. Just
take it. All right, take care.
Look at